You've been hearing ads for Zencastr for these past months. Interested in sponsoring this show or podcast ads for your business? Go to zen.ai/thearchaeologyshow and fill out the contact information so Zencastr can help you bring your business story to life.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 166.
On today's show, we deep dive ancient surgery, including the methods, history, and examples in the archaeological record.
Let's dig a little deeper into your skull. Ooh. Welcome to the show, everyone. How you doing?
Pretty good.
We are on the Oregon coast.
Yes, back to our kind of old stomping grounds. We've been here many times.
I know. Hopefully, if I get my crap together today, as you're listening to this, you can go to the Roadster Adventures Instagram page, R-O-D-S-T-E-R Instagram page, and see us pulling into my parents' house and having to cut half a tree down just to get the RV into its spot.
Yeah, totally. We were here almost two years ago, and it is crazy how much the tree that we were parked right next to last time has grown.
Not anymore.
Yeah, no. Well, it was partially dead. It needed to come down.
Yeah, those pieces had to go.
Yeah, it was not like you were attacking the tree for no reason.
No. But luckily, we had ladders, and my dad has a chainsaw, and it was easy to take it down. So, speaking of brutal cutting methods.
Oh, tell me more.
So this is one of our expansion episodes. I can't remember what I actually called it, like deep tracks.
Yeah, like deep dive.
Right. Yeah. I like deep tracks, though.
Okay.
So a few episodes ago, we had a news episode, and one of the things we mentioned was a 5,300-year-old earliest known ear surgery. That was episode 161, and it was the skull of an elderly woman, if you remember. If you don't remember, it means you're not a listener of the show, and you need to go back.
Yeah, just go back and listen to the episode.
And all the others.
Sure, all those too. But for this one specifically, it would be good to go listen to our discussion of that particular article.
And while you're at it, check out the rest of the Archaeology Podcast Network and spend 6 months of your life listening to our 4,000 episode back catalog.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot. Anyway, skull of an elderly woman. There was evidence of two surgeries. And
on both sides. Like both ears.
On both sides, yeah. And she lived through it because there's evidence of healing, you know, and she probably lived a few years at the very least.
Yeah. And we were just kind of blown away at the fact that this is 5,000 years ago.
Yeah.
She basically had surgery and survived.
And the thing is, the reason it's surgery, of course, is that it was intentional.
Yeah,
intentional. They literally scraped her head open.
Yep.
And they probably did use the scraping method, which we'll talk about later.
Yep.
But they scraped her head open to relieve pressure.
Yep.
And it worked.
Yeah. Kind of like an ear infection sort of a thing. Like she had probably they were speculating, but probably like an ear infection, and they just needed to get in there and relieve some kind of pressure. So, yeah.
So we wanted to kind of use that article as a jumping off point to talk about a little bit of kind of the history of surgery. And it's not really a history. There's a lot of different things, like how do you define it, stuff like that. But we're just going to talk about other surgical events and different important things throughout time that we found.
Yeah. And like how they're represented in the archaeological record. Sometimes it's not just the archaeological record. Sometimes it's also like historical written record as well, because, you know, for some cultures, we have that going back 2,000 years or even more.
Yeah.
So there's some pretty good evidence of what people were doing, and it's really, really interesting. So,
Yeah. So let's get into this a little bit. We're mostly talking about pretty old stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Surgery itself, as I wouldn't say as we know it today, but as it developed into what we know as today, really kind of exploded onto the scene in about the 19th century.
Yeah. And it was like somehow tied to barbers, which I just don't understand.
That's only
that
in
connection.
England.
Really?
Yeah. It was the barber surgeons and barbers and surgeons got together and joined and created like the Barber Surgeon Academy or something like that, or License Guild or something.
Sure. Cause like cutting hair and cutting into bodies, it's like the same thing, right?
Right. Well, it's like, this is kind of we're not supposed to talk about this yet, but we're starting the Archaeologist Hair Salon Collective. Basically, because when you're combing and cutting someone's hair, it's like troweling into an excavation unit. So we're just like,
it's kind of the same thing.
It's a natural fit. So no, I really, we didn't dive into barber surgeons. I'm sure there's reasons there.
Yeah.
And I think if I had to guess, it has to do with they both do cuttings and have materials and
things on the body, right?
Yeah. Also, somebody's already sitting in a chair and leaning back. You may as well drill into their head while you're, you know, cutting their hair. So,
wow.
Yeah. But they didn't do like the little bit of research I did do. The barber surgeons didn't do like real, like open you up surgery. Right. They did bloodletting through like leeches and stuff.
Oh yeah.
They did some trepanation.
Right.
They did some, you know, cutting a hole in your head. Mm-hmm. And they did some stuff like that. So they kind of had to stay in their lane a little bit, but you know, they did some things, but
okay.
Anyway, before the 19th century and not just barber surgeons, but around the world, mm-hmm. there wasn't really that much variation in what kind of surgeries were done. We've got prosthetics. We've got trepanation is all over the place because it's easy to drill into somebody's head, apparently. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a good fix for certain things. Mm-hmm. But, you know, surgery in the way that we think about it today, like, you know, really going in and understanding what the body looks like on the inside and knowing how to fix things and sewing stuff up internally and all that kind of stuff just wasn't huge. And one of the big reasons was infection is a real bitch.
Yeah, like they might have tried to go in and mess with things when somebody was sick or whatever, but it probably didn't end well because infection.
Yeah, like what kind of evidence would we have of like early surgical tries? It would just look like a butchery incident.
Right.
And all the soft tissue doesn't last anyway. So unless they saw it into somebody, like we just wouldn't even know it.
Right.
So anyway, some of the earliest signs of intentional what is being called surgery. I'd say anytime you're kind of like opening somebody up intentionally, mm-hmm. it's going to be called surgery, mm-hmm. right? So some of the earliest examples of that, at least that I was able to find, is around 6500 BCE. Mm-hmm. So, you know, about what, 8,500 years ago.
Yeah, give or take.
That is so long.
That is so long ago.
The Ice Age was still very much a real thing here in North America.
Yeah.
It was retreating, the ice was, but mm-hmm. there were massive lakes where there's now big cities.
Yeah, totally.
And people are drilling into people's heads.
So it makes sense that this was happening probably in France and Europe rather than over here in North America.
Right. Now, these early surgical pieces of evidence, let's call it, it's all trepanation.
Yeah.
Drilling holes in your head. Yeah. And you want to know why? Because that preserves in the archaeological record.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that was the first things they were doing. Somebody could have broken their arm and maybe a bone was like, I don't know, popped back into place and it was splinted or something. Maybe not. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But that is something we actually should be able to see, a healed fracture. And we do kind of see certain things like that. But how did it get to that point? Did they just like splint it up and it healed that way? Or did somebody actually do something? I don't know. The point is, like other forms of like soft tissue type surgery just like wouldn't be evident in the archaeological
record.
You're
just not going to see that. It's just
it was written about.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then we don't really have evidence of writing yet at that point.
Right.
So we're just not going to know about the things that they were doing to soft tissues. We just can't know.
Yeah. Now, a lot of stuff happened between that time and the next 4,000 years.
Yep.
But like, for example, a woman in France getting her skull drilled into.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But all kinds of people getting their skulls drilled into.
Yep.
But also, we know for a fact that the science of surgery and medicine was definitely progressing because by 1750 BCE, the Code of Hammurabi was written down. This is a Babylonian code of laws and details regulating and governing surgeons, mm-hmm. essentially.
Yep.
Medical malpractice, victims' compensation, all this stuff was mentioned in these laws. And for them in 1750 BCE to write down a code of laws about all these things means it was a problem.
Yeah.
You know, you only write down laws and codify things, I guess is the word, when stuff's going wrong.
Yeah, when people are constantly going to the lawmakers, like, look what this guy did to me, you know, compensation, that's when laws come into effect, for sure.
Exactly.
And it must have been a big enough business at that point.
I'm sure of it.
To require laws, too. So, well,
and you got to think, too, like, people were living in bigger and bigger cities back then, mm-hmm. around that time, and you know, you walk around a city today and you see guardrails, you see warning signs, you see all kinds of stuff. Willing to bet in ancient Babylonia, there was none of that. So a lot of people are hitting their heads on stuff. A lot of people are getting injured. Mm-hmm. You know, these kinds of regulations and safety measures that we have today just simply weren't around.
Right.
You know, so people are probably getting hurt a lot more. Over the next couple hundred years, a couple hundred years later, again, another codification of laws and stuff, the Ebers Papyrus, and it's really just named after, I think, the first person who found it or bought it or whatever.
Yeah, right.
Ancient Egyptian medical treaty includes info on how to surgically treat crocodile bites.
Sure, because those are big enough problem that we need to put it down on papyrus.
You know, it's a thing over there. Yeah. So,
that's so
crazy. Crocodile bites and serious burns. Yeah. When we were researching this, I told Rachel, I was like, I would legit want to print this out and just like leave it in random places in Florida.
Here's what to do.
In case of emergency, brick papyrus. Right. All right. So another 1,000 years passes and we have somebody named Sushruta. I think it was Indian. No. I can't remember, to be honest. 600 BCE, considered the founding father of surgery, mm-hmm. and did innovations in plastic surgery. And I even read rhinoplasty, like nose jobs.
No way, really? Yeah. That long ago?
Yeah.
Wow.
No, I don't know. Like
how good they were?
Yeah. Like, was it actually an improvement?
Right. Yeah. Well, maybe it was for their standards of beauty at the time. Who knows?
Right. Would he just like use early anesthetic or alcohol and just like punch him in the face repeatedly? Said, it's different now. So who knows?
Yep.
So progressing on, moving pretty quickly here because some of the histories I read are just covering sort of the highlights.
Yeah.
But 950 CE, we got Abulcasis, an Arab physician, considered among the greatest medieval surgeons. And he got his training from Greeks, from studying Greek surgeons.
Yeah.
Moving up to 1363 CE, Guy de Chauliac, a French surgeon, writes the Chirurgia Magna. It means great surgery.
Okay.
Standard text for surgeons until the 17th century. It stood for a long time.
Yeah.
Yep. And then you had the English barbers and surgeons uniting in 1540, performing both tooth extractions and bloodletting and stuff like that.
Oh, so it's like dentistry, too. It's kind of like all of
sure.
it.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
We're going to have to see if our brother-in-law can do some bloodletting next time we're out there as he's pulling teeth.
Right.
And then 1630, William Fabry, the father of German surgery, first to employ amputation as a treatment for gangrene.
I guess, but it's kind of a last resort. Well, I mean, gangrene will kill you, so, you know, cut it off to stop it from spreading. I guess it makes sense.
Indeed.
And they, you know, it seems so, like, barbarous to...
Barbarous? Like barbers?
No, like barbaric to just chop off a limb. But mm-hmm. I suppose they probably learned through trial and error that like they could seal up a wound from an amputated limb better than, you know, stopping the gangrene from spreading. So cool that they got there.
There's another cool thing that I apparently didn't take any notes about, but it is in our show notes called mm-hmm. the Edwin Smith Papyrus.
Oh.
And the Edwin Smith Papyrus is pretty cool. It's a... something like a 70-foot long scroll or something written on both sides in Egyptian hieratic, I think it was called, which is like a script version of writing hieroglyphs, which is crazy to me.
Yeah.
But
it's
anyway,
like taking the pictures and turning it into a script, essentially.
A little bit, but the pictures are still there.
Oh, okay.
Like you're moving from straight pictures, which were more used in religious and like inscriptions on walls and stuff. It was kind of a more formal way of doing things or had its own purposes.
Okay.
But anyway, this system of writing is not really the point of the story.
Right.
But it does help kind of date it, though.
Yeah.
But it was basically a surgical text on, you know, understanding the body and inside and really like organs. And I mean, a really early.
That is very early.
Yeah. Example of doing all this stuff. Yeah. So, and Edwin Smith is basically the guy that bought this thing back in the late
1800s. I was going to say, it doesn't sound like an Egyptian name, but I guess it makes sense.
The Pharaoh Edwin Smith actually lived. So,
no, it makes sense that it would be a British guy who, you know, probably illegally acquired said papyrus that would have his name attached to it. So, that makes sense.
Indeed.
Yep.
So, you know, for the rest of this podcast, we're going to talk about in segment two, some surgical methods and practices. And then in segment three, we're going to talk about some actual examples and other things, some real specific things about surgery.
Like
so,
in the archaeological record, like where we've seen it.
Yeah. And I know you're probably thinking, man, I need more articles. Like I need a hole in the head. But, on the other side of this break, we're literally going to talk about holes in the head. Back in a minute. Chris Webster here. I have a pretty full calendar, and managing that calendar can be pretty challenging.
I've got things to do every day and things I need to do once a week. Of course, people book on my calendar all the time, and I have to manage that as well. I used to move my recurring events around when something would disrupt them, but now I don't have to. This is where Motion comes in. It's an intelligent AI that manages your day for you. Put events that don't involve other people in as tasks, and Motion will move them around and break them up in ways that you dictate so you get everything done. If you'd like to take back your time and your day, then head over to arcpodnet.com/motion and check it out. That's arcpodnet.com/motion to get at least 25% more efficient with your time.
Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Register of Professional Archaeologists and the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's paleoimaging.com, and check out the link in the show notes. Chris Webster here from the APN. You've heard me talk about Zencastr for a few months now, and there's never been a better time to check this out and start a podcast. Zencastr has hosting tools and both audio and video podcasting capability. Many of you have already clicked on the link in the show notes, and we thank you for that. Use the code TAS, that's TAS, at the link in the show notes, or go to Zencastr.com and use the code. That's Zencastr.com to get 30% off your first 3 months. Again, use the code TAS for 30% off your first 3 months at Zencastr.com.
Welcome back to episode 166 of the Archaeology Show. And we are moving to some of the actual surgical methods and practices that we found evidence for while we were doing our research.
Yeah.
And there's not that many of them, obviously. Like we said in segment one, surgery, we're not going to see what people do to the soft tissues. Like, there's just no way for that to be preserved in the archaeological record. So it's what people were doing to the bones. That's really the only thing that we can have evidence for. So as we mentioned already, trepanation or trephination, depending on...
Trephination? I didn't see that one.
Yeah, there's like some weirdness with that word and like the origins of it. And it seems like trepanation is the most commonly used one, but you might see trephination as well. We'll just use trepanation for this discussion.
One thing I did notice is that people that have had trepanation on them are called trepanned patients.
Yeah.
I know, I saw that in an article somewhere.
Yep. Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. All right. Let's trephanate this bitch.
So trepanation would be the most common practice, surgical practice that we would see in the archaeological record. And this is, of course, cutting a purposeful hole in the skull. And there's lots of medical reasons why they would have done that. Mostly around relieving pressure from a head injury, sometimes removing small skull fragments. Like if there was some kind of like blunt force trauma situation and there were skull fragments in there they needed to get out, they might cut a hole to help them do that. Drainage is another reason they might. And then also I read Egypt specifically, migraine relief. Like you've got like such a terrible pain in your head that they think that maybe like drilling a hole in it will help. I'm not
like
really
to
sure.
Just focus the pain somewhere else, maybe?
I guess maybe.
I don't know. Your arm would also, you know,
like take the
that.
Pain away.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not really sure how well that these things, that trepanation worked for these problems and issues. It must have worked well enough, though, because we see it all throughout history and all throughout the world and in different cultures. So,
yeah. Anyway. And of course, there's some. A little bit of woo involved in these things.
You have to sort of forgive ancient peoples for not really understanding what caused the problems that they were seeing in their bodies. But there could be some like spiritual reasons, like releasing bad spirits or evil vapors or bad humors or something like that. That would be another reason they would drill holes.
I usually get bad humor when I release the spirits from the bottle.
Yeah.
That was a bad joke.
Yeah. We'll talk about the humors thing later on in this segment, but it was a big part of medical history, basically. So also another reason they might have done trepanation on a person was to treat mental illness or epilepsy. That practice mostly stopped by the 1700s, I think, because they realized that people were
not getting cured.
No, like it wasn't making them less mentally ill. It wasn't stopping the epilepsy. So it was like a group of people tried that for a while, medieval times-ish, and then it just like didn't work, so it sort of faded away.
Well, as far as mental illness goes too, like, sure, that's a broad class of illness and disease, but like it's thousands of things.
So
maybe drilling a hole in your head might actually cure somebody of something.
You know what? It actually could, because mental illness could be, because it's such a broad term. Like you said, it could be it could be caused by some kind of pressure in the brain that would then cure it. So I think there's a lot of like vague practice and behavior around around that. So, you know, it's like taking a shot in the dark, a lot of what they were doing.
Yeah.
In, you know, before we had more and better knowledge about medicine.
I'd rather take a shot than a, you know, hold of the skull.
So. Depends on the kind of shot.
Is it trepidation when it's just a hole in the head? Because what would it be called if, I'm sure people had infections or something happened on other parts of their body where you have a like you can see a swelling up, and maybe they thought puncturing that would have been a good idea. Is trepidation the act of drilling, or is it just like drilling into the head? I wonder. I don't know.
It's just drilling into the head because the skull is the only enclosed thing in like skull thing that you can drill into, you know, that has something inside of it.
Yeah.
Everything else, it's like a larger piece of bone, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I'm explaining that very well, but
yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah. So the practice of trepanation, it occurred worldwide from the Neolithic period, as we discussed previously, and then practically all the way up until today to modern times. There are some African cultures that have, you know, very recently been performing trepanations. So
I mean, if it still works and you don't have access to other medical care.
Yeah. And if it's something that maybe you have a lot of different reasons for doing it, like we mentioned earlier, so it could be a spiritual thing rather than a medical thing. So there's lots of reasons people are doing it.
Yeah. Some of the earliest writings about this are from the Greek, like the Hippocratic work, Titles on Wounds in the Head. I love that title.
I know. Great title.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then there's also a Chinese legend, like an ancient Chinese legend, that refers to a technique that sounds kind of like drilling into a head, but it's a legend and not a medical text. And also, like, the guy in the legend who performed it had, like, a really bad end where the trepanation didn't work and he was executed kind of a situation.
Right.
So it's really unclear if that's a legend or if it was a thing that really happened.
I'm imagining it wasn't actually written down. It was just like in images on a plate. That's how we know about it.
Yeah.
So
trepanation, it was used all through Neolithic and then into, you know, medieval times up until the 1800s, right? But when medicine started moving into hospitals, it kind of stopped for a little while. And this is because of the risk of infection. And if you think about it, it makes sense. You know, you're opening up a hole in somebody's skull and then they move into a hospital where there's all kinds of other sick people and viruses and things around. And then they're getting infections, or I guess bacteria, not viruses, but they're getting infections and people were dying from the act. So they kind of stopped doing it. Now, it comes back into play in modern medicine when you have a sterile environment. But until that happens in the 1900s, it kind of just sort of stopped.
I think we also talked about, too, how hospitals themselves kind of became like a den of infection because they didn't really understand what was causing all that stuff. And they're bringing all these sick people into one place and not really understanding the impacts of doing that yet.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the different types of trepanation really quick. There is the rectangular style, which would be like cross, like square cuts. And they usually like intersect at the corners and go past each other.
Yeah.
And that one is seen specifically in Peruvian skulls. Then there is my personal favorite, scraping.
Ugh.
And they would literally take something sharp, like it could be like a scraper, like an actual scraper, and like scrape away. I'm sure they cut the skin away, but then they just scrape away the bone, just scrape, 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 scrape. And it could take like hours to do it that way. Ugh, seems so terrible. There's the bored hole, which is kind of like taking I think it's called a crown saw, right? Where there's like a hole and it bores a hole straight into the skull. You just have to be very careful not to hit the brain underneath. Yeah. And then the final one is a circle of drilled circles, basically. So you go boop, 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 all the way around in a circle, and then you can pop the piece of skull out.
Now, keep in mind, when somebody's getting this done, they're probably doing it like where there's a massive pressure or trauma already.
Yeah.
The pain involved in this.
Oh, I can't even imagine.
Now, it might be actually beneficial if somebody like passes out from the pain.
Oh, I hope they did. I sincerely hope that anybody who had to experience this passed out, or was given enough alcohol to pass out or something. I don't know, because mm-hmm. they didn't really have anesthetic for most of the time that these were being done. So, All right. Well, moving on from trepanation, let's just talk quickly about a couple of other things that we know about that people were doing. Mm-hmm. One of them would be bloodletting. And
sounds fun.
Yeah. I mean, I think that this is a pretty well-known historical technique for dealing with issues. And I put it into the surgery category just because you do have to cut into the body.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really have evidence of it so much in the archaeological record because this would be into the soft tissues. So we're really relying on like written accounts of it. We don't really know exactly when it began, but the thought is probably in Egypt. But the first written accounts are by the Greeks.
Wonder why they think it started in Egypt first.
I don't know. Yeah. It might be because of the influential physicians like Hippocrates and Galen, who are the ones who like were talking about using it in these Greek texts. Mm-hmm. And they maintained that the human body was filled with four basic substances or humors, like we mentioned earlier. This would be yellow bile, black bile, phlegm, and blood. And to have proper health, these needed to be kept in balance, essentially.
It's not entirely wrong.
Well, I mean, it's a little, there's some stuff wrong there, but you know, balance is key. Like, I guess with a body, you need to have everything in balance in order to work properly. They just didn't know the different pieces and how they fit together. So they created this four humors idea
And that's where bloodletting comes in. Make a cut in the body or use leeches or something like that to basically, you know, you got too much blood.
Yeah.
You got to take some of this out.
Well, I think they thought that the humors were like in with the blood sometimes and like weren't visible. So like when you're letting blood out, you're letting out other things too. It's
or maybe you're you maybe you, they somehow through some medical deductive reasoning said that you have less of something else, one of the other humors.
Oh yeah,
and reduce the blood to bring that back
to
into
bring it
balance.
Back into balance. Yeah,
I mean maybe. Not realizing your body's just gonna like make more.
Right. So. Yeah, and they would do that by cutting or with leeches depending on the place and the time and whatever. So. Now, that practice mostly stopped by the 19th century because I think they basically realized it did nothing. And actually, if they didn't take a lot of care with the cuts, they could cause somebody to like fully bleed out.
So
that mostly stopped. Now, the other interesting thing, and we do see this in the archaeological record, is bone setting.
Mm.
And there are examples of healed fractures that must have been set and splinted in order to heal the way that we see them healed on in the bones.
Yeah.
And so that's really cool. And there's evidence of it around the world, basically similar to trepanation. We see evidence of bone setting, but there's one really cool one. And I'll read a quote here. It's from a Spanish text that they encountered Aztecs that treated broken bones by reduction.
Hmm.
And here's the quote. The broken bone had to be splinted, extended, and adjusted. And if this was not sufficient, an incision was made at the end of the bone and a branch of fur was inserted into the cavity of the medulla.
That sounds gross.
I know, right? So like they would recognize that the bone needed to be basically like cut almost, probably whatever jagged edges there were.
Yeah.
And then if it wasn't the right length, they would, you know, put a piece of wood in there to help stabilize it, which I don't even know how that would have properly worked. But anyway, that's just really cool that the Aztecs were doing this.
Yeah,
that long ago.
That is super crazy.
Yeah.
I don't even know what to say on that.
I know.
Yeah. Like, some of the things. And it makes me wonder, too, you know, if we can bring all this together with an episode we had not too long ago that chilled me to my core, although I knew it was true. You think any of these bad trepanation examples where it just didn't go so well? Because I'm sure for every one where they're like, hey, thanks for relieving the pressure.
Yeah.
The patient just like died.
Like died, right.
But now they've got a hole in their head and you're looking at that brain and they're like, well, like, John's dead, but we've got this leather that needs tanning over here.
No.
So we just scoop out his brains?
No.
Because we don't have any moose left.
Oh, my God, no. That's terrible. I don't think that it would inspire cannibalistic behavior, basically. Yeah, well, I guess they weren't eating it, but anyway, no.
If they did live, as we mentioned, they had to cover it with something. And sometimes you just put a little window in there with like a metal plate that maybe can be removed, like your little cyborg. Let's talk about that on the other side of the break.
We've got a contest. The folks over at AEO Screen are giving one of our listeners a brand new screen. Pick anything from their website and they'll ship it to you. Not an archaeologist? No problem. These are great for gardening and other tasks around the house. I mean, come on, right? Anyway, these are great screens and you won't be disappointed. We'll pick the winning entry at the end of May. Head over to arcpodnet.com/screen for details on how to enter. It's easy and you can get multiple entries. Increase your chances by helping out others. That's arcpodnet.com/screen for details on how to win. Want to keep this conversation going? Want to talk to the host of this show and other fans? Then join our membership program and get exclusive access to the hosts, other fans, and early access to these episodes and bonus segments and content. You'll also get forever access to our live show back catalog and any other shows ad-free. Head over to arcpodnet.com/members for details. That's arcpodnet.com/members.
Welcome back to episode 166. Of the Archaeology Show. We're talking about ancient surgery. Before we do that, be sure to head over to arcpodnet.com/something. I don't know. I'll figure it out.
You have a website, right?
I do have a website. arcpodnet.com. If you click on the hamburger icon, which is like the little menu icon if your system's all squished up and you're on your phone, or if you're on the website and it's all spread out, look at the shop icon and then there's affiliates down there. We have some pretty good affiliates and there's one that hopefully you're going to hear an ad about soon, if not on this show, for Motion. Mm-hmm. Motion's something that's been changing our lives. It's really kind of it's more than a calendar scheduling tool. It's more of a task manager that's using AI to plan your day for you.
Yeah.
Sounds crazy, cool. But it's actually true.
Yeah, it's
and,
cool.
Yeah, APN gets a little kickback if you use our link, but you also save money as well. So anyway, check that out. Check out our affiliates and everything else at arcpodnet.com. Okay, so last segment here, let's talk about a few cool examples that we found of some neat things that people have done in the past. And these are actually also related to some relatively recent news articles that were out. So
yep.
We're going to save one of these for the bonus. Mm-hmm. So if you're a member, go over to your member page, arcpodnet.com/members, to see how to sign up. But also, once you're on there, there's the members link and you can just click on bonus stuff. I think it's just bonus content. Mm-hmm. And check out the final segment. The first thing we'll talk about is a prosthetic toe. Not surgery per se, although...
But the result of surgery,
yeah,
kind of.
I don't actually know because they were really focusing on the prosthetic and I couldn't find the original paper, but do we have evidence maybe that the toe was amputated or was the toe lost in a thing? Or was it just like maybe they were born with a birth defect? Like, I have no idea, right?
Yeah, so. Yeah. But there's no reason why a prosthetic toe couldn't have been the result or the... Not the result of surgery. What am I trying to say?
It just augments the after the surgery.
Yeah.
A prosthetic is not surgery.
No.
It's what you do afterwards to help somebody gain a semblance of living.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it very well could have been related to a surgery.
Yeah, it could have been. Could have been. Now, this is from Luxor, Egypt, and it's known as the Cairo toe, or what's even better, the Grenville Chester great toe. I'm not really sure.
Oh my God.
What's going on there.
That's fantastic.
3,000 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, it's thought to be the earliest prosthesis ever discovered, and a recent look using microscopy, x-rays, and computer tomography, which is basically just mapping. Mm-hmm. The 3D scans that all that basically produced identified the materials the prosthesis was made from and how it was crafted.
Oh, that's cool.
And here's this thing gets really kind of cool here in a minute. This was refitted several times to exactly match the woman's foot.
Now, how could they know that it was refitted several times?
I think because from what I was looking at it, there's actually a bunch of articulating pieces of this thing, which we'll get to in a second. That's an important point to this, this actual prosthesis.
Right.
And it probably had different adjustment points where maybe different things were sewn together and stuff like that. And it was like altered or changed.
Okay.
Now they're saying refitted, but that also could mean it just like broke and they had to put it back together again.
Yeah, it could.
You know, something like that.
But I mean, I know somebody who has a prosthetic leg.
Yeah.
And he was constantly going back to the doctor to have it repositioned, refitted. Just because, like, over time, like, small discomforts will happen and it just needs to be
It's like
refitted.
A pair of shoes. Your shoes wear out.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, why wouldn't your prosthetic wear out?
Yeah, yeah, there's that. And then also his favorite, he would still have to have refittings done because, you know, just over time, things change and whatever, so...
Yeah. And one of the things they saw in here, as opposed to, other prosthetics in the archaeological record, which range from, I mean, literally they found like gold or like bronze legs and stuff like that, that somebody would wear.
Right.
Clearly a prosthesis, but also not a functional one.
No.
That would be more for somebody who's rich to sit there on their throne or chair and just like not have a missing leg. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause you can't walk around with a gold leg. That would be absolutely insane and heavy.
Exactly. But there's other things too. Like they've seen prosthetic toes and things like that before. Not before this one. This is one of the earlier ones, but, but since even that were again, not very functional and probably not that comfortable. Again, a lot of the prostheses seem to, of course, your lower classes, so to speak, are not going to be able to afford something like this.
Right.
But so this is really more for the upper classes. And a lot of the prostheses early on were thought to have just been so they don't look weird.
Yeah.
You know, they can still wear a shoe. They can put something on it, or if it's an arm or whatever the case. But it was very not functional.
Mm-hmm.
This one, however, has a lot of like articulating little pieces, and they're pretty sure that the woman who wore this was high status and could just like walk around with it on.
Like,
and
it
probably
functional.
With little discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it was a real, and it was just like her, it looks like it was just her big toe on her right foot, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the toe right next to it. So
was it made of like wood or something like that?
It looked like leather.
Oh, like leather.
Like
okay.
Leather and wood that was like sewn together.
Okay. So, but materials that would decompose unless they're preserved super well.
Well, I mean, this is the Egyptian desert. She was mummified, put into a tomb like everybody was.
Okay, so it's with the mummy.
And yeah, and so we there's excellent preservation down there for that kind of stuff.
I'm just curious why we don't see more examples of this. If it was something that was done commonly, it makes me wonder if it wasn't a common practice and it's an unusual situation and we just happen to have really good example of it.
Well,
or if it's bad preservation. That means is why we don't have other examples.
I mean, here's the thing. This thing would have taken a lot of skill and artistry to create because not only do you have to understand human physiognomy to be able to put this thing together and understand what the toe is for and how people walk and to be able to make adjustments and listen to the patient and you know, like craft what they actually need for their foot.
Right.
But all of that would have been a massive expense, and that person who is able to do that or people would have been in limited supply and limited only to the elite.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how often do the elite lose toes?
Right.
Probably not that often.
Right.
Right. Like, how did this even happen? You know, like she fall down a pyramid, like how, you know, like what was going
on?
Right. Probably something.
Right.
Probably a crocodile bite. I don't even know.
You don't even know.
This could be one of the treatments. So
totally.
Anyway, it was just really cool. The link is in the show notes. They've got an awesome picture of it.
Yeah, and that picture is really cool.
I mean, it looks like something like if I lost my toe today,
like you could strap that on and walk around.
Why not have fun with it?
Yeah, totally.
You know, just have fun with your amputation and use something ancient and fun. That would be super cool. Because all the prostheses today, I mean, they range from, to be honest, kind of boring, just like plastic pieces to really kind of space agey, cool looking things.
Oh, yeah. Like the ones that are meant for running
are
so cool looking.
Those are just like, those are wacky.
Yeah, that's amazing.
But yeah, why not just like occasionally put something steampunky or like early Egyptian on? I would totally do that.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to have an amputation, so I don't want to just like make that happen. But,
no.
But if I did, I would 100% have fun with it. Like if I was missing my hand or something like that, especially my left hand, I would have an attachment for like an Apple Pencil stylus. So I can just do whatever I need. So, all right. So let's go from Egypt all the way over to Peru. And it's about 1,000 years later.
Mm-hmm.
But the Peruvians were also doing some cool things. And this, to me, is, I don't know if it's just a different way of thinking, too. Mm-hmm. It's just a really cool thing. But 2,000 years ago, a Peruvian warrior's skull sustained damage. Now, it couldn't have been, to me, just like your average warrior. It had to be somebody important.
Probably.
Because they really tried to save this person.
Yeah.
Basically, their hole was essentially filled with a metal plate.
That's so crazy.
As a repair.
That is so crazy. Oh, and like the bone even fused around the plate so that you know that they had the procedure. And there was healing, and it was successful. They lived long enough for the bone to grow around the plate. That's so cool.
Yeah, and I was thinking, I don't know if the pictures are accurate in the article that I saw, if they're just like pulling stuff up or whatever, because it looks like it's rusted. But they didn't have steel.
Right.
Yeah, so it couldn't really have been rusted, but it did say that often gold or some other precious metals were used, you know, so they'd have to make that out of like plate, which is actually pretty good because I think gold is like naturally
silver,
gold and silver. Yeah. They're naturally resistant to infection. Yeah. They're antibacterial.
Antibacterial. Yeah. Yeah. Silver definitely is. I don't know about gold.
Yeah.
But there's like some really expensive socks you can buy that have silver in them. It's antibacterial.
Oh, yeah. That's the reason. Don't touch my $800 socks. So, and this is obviously essentially classified as trepanation because they had to, it sounds like the hole was put there like by
some sort of battle blunt force injury.
Trauma. Yeah. Either battle or training or something. I imagine if it were battle, you know, like how do you pull this guy off the battlefield and then do surgery on him? So I don't know. But anyway, so something like that happened and then they probably had to clean it out. It looks like from the plate that they actually had to probably cut a little more bone away and then affix the plate to it. Now, I don't know how I don't think we would ever know this, but they probably just like bandaged it in a way.
Yeah. I would assume. Like waited for skin.
Yeah. And probably a lot of maintenance on this thing.
Yeah. Because like the skin would grow over it.
Yeah.
To hold it in place. Well, and then the bone eventually.
Yeah. And they had like early poultices and stuff like that. A thing that they would put together with herbs and plants and stuff and probably smear that over it, you know, which kind of worked.
Which may have done more bad than good, depending on what it was, I suppose.
Yeah.
Although these people, I mean, they had their healing techniques. They learned what worked and what didn't work. And humans are very resilient. Mm-hmm. So they probably actually did have some pretty good natural herbs and things to deal with it.
Yeah, for sure. There was a study done by World Neurosurgery in 2018. And the Inca era, this is just an interesting statistic. The Inca era success rate for trepanned patients was 80%.
That's insane.
Yeah. Now, I think that just means they lived long enough for us to see some sort of healing in the bone.
The healing, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Doesn't really say what their quality of life was.
No.
Doesn't really say whether it like cured them.
Right.
But they lived.
They lived.
Through the process.
Which makes you wonder because the Incan method tended to be the cutting out the rectangular chunk rather than trying to bore a hole or do the drilled small holes or scraping or whatever like the other techniques are. So it makes you wonder if that like crisscrossed, like a hatch mark basically of pulling the square out.
Right.
If that is like the best way to do it, maybe.
I don't know. Well, let's crisscross the globe and head over to London and talk about one more thing.
Okay.
And this was 4,000 years ago, and really wasn't London. They're calling it London brain surgery because this guy, Chelsea Man, they're calling him, was found in the Chelsea area of London.
Right.
But he was found along the Thames, and there's evidence of scraping on the skull, which we talked about earlier, obviously trepanation.
Uh-huh.
And the scraping was seen as a more advanced technique at the time than drilling.
Okay.
Drilling, and I don't know why, but I would imagine drilling is just less precise because you could just like
puncture
right through the brain.
Yeah, I bet you're totally right.
Yeah.
And
scraping is just more careful.
It is more careful, but it takes a lot more time too. So you have to have a patient that you can keep subdued long enough to actually scrape it away. So that is really interesting.
Right. And calling it brain surgery is a little much because they were definitely not doing anything to the brain.
Right.
We still barely understand the brain.
Yeah, so. it was basically just the pressure relief or whatever it was that they needed a hole in the skull for.
Yeah, but basically scraping when done by somebody who has either done this before or knows what they're doing and has a steady hand, you know, really careful scraping and, you know, even possibly with a local anesthetic because there were things you could, you know, herbs and things you could put on your body to numb the area.
Sure.
So that could have helped.
Yeah.
Or maybe just alcohol, but I don't know if they had alcohol in that area 4,000 years ago.
Or in the kind of like levels you would need to make somebody pass out.
Right.
Actually, an alcohol would be really bad because it thins your blood. So it actually makes you bleed more. So
well, they would have known that.
They wouldn't have known that, but with observation over time, they might have seen that that's actually like a really bad idea.
Anyway, doing it slow and methodically, and there's evidence of that because if it's, you know, you can see the scraping happening, you know, so, but anyway, after the pressure was relieved, it could have been filled with dried leaves or bark. And then this patient in particular lived for a few years after that surgery, at least.
Like, walk me through that though. Like, you fill it with dried leaves, bark, some kind of poultice, like you said. Does it just Where does it, do you have to go back in and pull it out after it heals a little bit? Like, how does that work?
I mean, I'm sure some of that would just like stay in your head, but
that can't be good, right?
Well, it can't be, but it's better than dying. Well, right?
Yeah.
So anyway.
Oh, crazy. The whole, just like anything to do with like the brain and the head is just,
yeah.
It makes me, it's like, yeah. Gives me that icky shiver, you know?
It's pretty gross.
Yeah.
So. But that's what led to, you know, modern practices that we have today.
Yeah.
Human
ingenuity is amazing, and the things that they learned how to do. And the fact that trepanation is a technique that you see all across the world, meaning different cultures and different times developed it. It's just so cool that humans could come up with like that as a solution for medical issues.
And if you're one of those people that shuns Western medicine and modern medical practices, I would be more than happy to scrape a hole in your skull if you got a headache. So let's meet up. Use some ancient Chinese, European, British, African, Egyptian, Native American medicine.
Your ancient medicine poison.
They all did it. I will rub some leaves on it when I'm done. And I swear you will be in...
You will be cured.
You will be in a different condition than when you arrived. That is my guarantee.
Oh, my God.
All right. Well,
I'm not sure that we've mentioned this before, but we're like pretty skeptical people. So
I think it's come out.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Okay. So as mentioned, we're going to have a bonus segment. So check your member content and we're going to talk about where syringes came from.
Yeah.
And some of the first people to do this. Yeah. There's actually two different origin stories for syringes. And we'll talk about that in the bonus segment. For everybody else, I mean, go be a member. We could really use them.
Yep.
Hey, we're going to start running a contest here at some point, too. I'm going to run this as an ad, so it's more dynamic and not in the old shows.
Yeah, so don't skip the ad.
Don't skip the ads.
Listen to it, because it's a contest.
Yeah. But the contest is going to be for... We're going to include membership and social media promotion, but it's going to be for winning a screen, a screen for doing archaeological work. And if you're not an archaeologist, you can still use that screen in, the garden and for separating materials and maybe just doing some local archaeology in your backyard.
Yeah, as long as it's private property.
Yeah, but there's a company that's offering us one to send directly from them to one of our winners. So keep your eyes, or ears, I should say, peeled for that. Mm-hmm, well, definitely. Your eyes too. Probably put some ads up.
I mean, you guys all show up to an archaeological project with your own shovel or your own trowel, right? Why wouldn't you want to show up with your own screen?
Yeah.
Makes total sense.
Exactly. So, and again, good for non-archaeologists as well for lots of different things around the house.
Yeah, it's good.
I mean, you could probably put cookie dough in it and push it through and make these little cookie dough straws. You know, maybe you could jam some potatoes through it, make some french fries.
I'm not really sure. You got to sharpen the mesh to
it's a quarter inch. It's good for lots of things. Oh. You know what's not good for lots of things? This show. We'll be back next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks for listening. Please consider joining our growing core of members over at archpodnet.com/members. If you liked what you heard, consider leaving a review wherever you're listening to this.